Before we get into this episode, we got a lot of negative feedback, mostly about my tone in this episode that you're about to hear. And I thought it would be a good opportunity for me to basically talk with Lisa and Laura about it. And so here we are. I was afraid when I listened to the edit of this that people might get the wrong impression. What listeners can't see are the smiles on our faces or our body language. I readily admit that I get passionate when I discuss hot topics, but I have absolutely no animosity at all towards Lisa. However, I know Lisa is asking questions or stating opinions that she's read or heard about, and she's doing that to get my honest reactions to them. I'm not saying that my reactions are always perfect or proper, but it's my firm belief that the way certain issues are portrayed on this show manipulates viewers into believing something that I believe is strongly contradicted by fact. So I feel a responsibility to point that out, and yes, I do get passionate about it. I will, however, be more cognizant of the fact that listeners are only getting part of the picture and don't see that Lisa and I love and respect each other, and we are literally engaging in a real-time, real discussion. We don't manage this or produce this. We don't script what we're about to say. We literally have discussions, and sometimes they get heated. But it doesn't have anything to do with respect. Although I am definitely somebody who speaks quickly, and sometimes I am on a roll, and so I will try to be more careful about not stepping on you if you're talking about something.
Yeah, and I want to say I appreciate all of the feedback that you guys have given us, and I was so excited to drop this episode because when Jim and I had left the booth after recording it, I was like, damn, we got down and deep into this case, and I felt very invigorated, and so I was really sad to read the comments because I certainly didn't feel any animosity in the booth when we were recording. I felt that Jim was getting passionate about the Fakakta defense that these offenders had put forth, and he was angry at them. And I certainly didn't take it personally. And I re-listened to the episode over and over again after all of your comments. And I was like, gosh, I hear us laughing and I hear us agreeing and I hear some talking over each other, you know, and that happens. You know, however, you know, I understand that this triggered a lot of people. And I want to thank you, so many of you, for coming to my defense. And it really moved me. I mean, I'm going to start crying. Oh, my God. You know, nobody's ever defended me like this before.
Well,
but
Laura and I have.
No, I know. Yeah. But towards perceived slights and people bullying me. Oh, my God. Where were you guys when I was in middle school? I could have really used you. But, right. You know, I, Jim and I love each other. And if you're in the booth with us, and I know that you're not, you know, you would see us gesticulating and nodding our heads and smiling. And, you know, I know it's hard. You can't see that. But, you know, that's what's really going on here.
Yeah. And if you recall, Lisa, in the beginning of this very podcast, in a number of the first months of us doing this, people were attacking you, literally attacking you. Why are you on this? Why are you trying to give your opinions?
Yeah.
And Laura and I both jumped in to defend you because you are a very important part of this. You help balance us. You help us give the opinions of everyone else that's listening that isn't experienced the way Laura and I are in, unfortunately, the depths of the worst things that people do to each other. And so we defended you heartfeltly because we love you and we're so happy to be a team together with you. So
thank you.
So yeah, we're a team and that's an important part of what we do. And I think, you know, we're not a TV show. You can't see what's going on in terms of the dynamics, although we all agree that sometimes we need to take a breath before we speak because we're all people who feel very, you know, passionately about certain subjects and when it comes to victims and victims not getting justice, and that's something that's all, it's very close to our hearts. But we take your feedback on board, so we want you to know that we have been reading every tweet and every Facebook post that you've sent, and we do appreciate your interaction with us. And so to balance it out, we will try and take a breath, Jim C and me definitely included,
and
Lisa, and, you know, we want you to carry on listening to us because we are real people, not scripted. We do just come in. We don't know what each other's going to say. And sometimes when it's a two dynamic, it can be more intense. Sometimes when it's a three, you know, it's hard to get a word in at times, certainly for me being British. But we take your comments on board. So thank you for taking the time and the energy and effort of letting us know what you think. And we hope that you're going to continue in listening because we've got some great subjects coming
Absolutely.
Up.
Absolutely.
And speaking of that, we're going to be talking very shortly about the special project that Laura and I did recently. And there's been some news about it, I think, but we're not yet able to actually do a podcast on it. But those podcasts are coming.
They certainly are. While it's still all in our heads, along with lots of other things that are going on. So yeah, we're excited about that. And about CrimeCon, we've got that coming up too. So we hope to see many of you at CrimeCon again Nashville.
That's right. I'm already shopping for it. I'm already trying to get my outfits. So anyway.
And if there's any nice sponsor who wants to sponsor us outfits at CrimeCon, then we're
shoes.
All about that.
So the Toad, if
Yeah, the Toad, if you're listening, we could use it. Laura and I, they don't have it for guys, sorry. But Laura and I could use you to style us for our event.
That would be glorious.
So please keep all this in mind as you listen to this episode, and we really appreciate you listening.
I need an ambulance.
Okay. What's the problem there?
There's been some kind of break-in.
My friend, his mom and dad, we think they're dead.
Why do you think that they're dead?
There's blood, they're not breathing, there's blood all over his face.
Just calm down.
I don't think it's safe here. We'll be outside.
Okay, go ahead and go outside.
Please, fast, okay?
Yes, they're on the way.
Okay.
They're on the way.
We'll be outside.
Okay, go ahead.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor, and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today in the studio is...
Lisa Zambetti. I am the casting director for Criminal Minds, where Jim Clemente is my colleague. Real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. And unfortunately, Laura is not with us today. She is taking a well-deserved holiday before Jim and she go back into their super secret special case that they're working
on. That's right. And so today we're going to talk about a new Netflix original series called The Confession Tapes. And this is a series that delves into whether or not certain confessions are false confessions. And the first two episodes are the ones we're going to cover today.
Yeah, this was a lot of you guys have recommended that we listen to the confession tapes, and it was on our list to cover. But then somebody specifically pointed us into the direction of the first two episodes, which are about the Raffae family murders, which I'd never heard of. Jim, had you heard of it before now?
I don't recall whether I'd known it, but
I'd heard of the lore. So much. I think our showrunner actually told me about this case. The lore of the case, and we'll get into that about the writing of the screenplay and everything like that.
Got it.
So yeah, so there are two episodes. They're called True East.
True East, just so you know, is based on the fact that father of the Raffae family, Dr. Raffae, was an engineer, and he did some calculations and figured out that what everybody else believed was True East was actually 1 or 1.5 degrees off of True East. And he wanted that rectified because in the Muslim religion, they're supposed to pray aiming towards True East. And he thought that that was 1 degree or 1.5 degrees off. Apparently, that's a controversial topic, and that may play into this a little later.
Right. He had made a calculation that the mosques in Bellevue were off. And so he made a whole bunch of people mad in Bellevue with that and among other things. And he had been a president of a Canadian Muslim organization. So he, he held a high office in that community. But yes, so he, Tariq, and his wife, Sultana, their daughter, Basma, had moved to Bellevue just a couple days before they were murdered. At the time, their son, Atif, was in his was a freshman at Cornell and had come home to visit after that year. These two episodes are about those murders.
Right. So let's break down what happened. So the case begins with a 911 call And the call comes in to the police department in Bellevue at about 2:30 in the morning. And the call is made by Sebastian Burns. The first thing that strikes me about this, and we've just played that 911 tape, is that I believe this is a very clear indication of feigned fear and feigned inability to communicate. And why I believe that is because of word choice and pauses, and then just easily constructed rapid sentences right at the end when he knows it's over and gets rid of the 911 operator. And that is an indication that we see time and time again when people have scripted a 911 call. They want to say a certain amount of things, and then they don't want to say anything more, and they get off the phone, they hang up. Now, they purportedly were afraid. They went outside because they thought the bad guys could still be in the house. They didn't do two things. One, run away, or two, do anything to protect his sister, who they knew to be still alive. And those two things tell me again that this was a deliberate attempt to make it look like they were afraid when in fact they weren't. They were standing outside, they gave their stories to the cops, and then were pissed that they had to restate those stories to detectives. And again, this behavior right from the start is incredibly telling.
Right. So I don't want to spoiler alert too soon what we think, if this is they're guilty, but that's fine. When I hear that tape, and I am not, as you know, in law enforcement, but I do listen to these kind of lines all the time in my work. And Sebastian is doing things that I tell actors not to do. He's got that heavy breathing, indicating that he's panicked. And
okay, I need ambulance. There's been some kind of break-in. The two, we think they're dead. It's just garbage. Yeah. He's completely able to articulate at the end. Yes, we'll be outside. Hurry, hurry, hurry. Come right out. Come now. Come fast. Whatever. He's very able to articulate. He isn't falling apart. And it's just the inconsistencies within that statement belie an intentional attempt to make it look like he's in fear and unable to communicate.
And is there anything he's the one who calls 911 and not the son of these?
Well, I mean, purportedly it could be because the son is too upset. That would make sense in terms of if you're going to plan who should be making the call. But the fact is that Atif, when the police come, admits that he heard his sister alive and in distress, and he left the house. He left her there. That, in and of itself, tells me volumes. And we'll get back to that later at the end of the trial when he tries to say how much this affected him.
Completely agree with you. You're going to hear me sort of giving you alternate questions, and I'm not
absolutely
trying to be argumentative.
No, I want to address them.
So I'm just trying to be consistent in because we've learned so much from studying the Amanda Knox's case and all these other cases. And, when Amanda walked in to a very bloody apartment and she leaves without seeing if Meredith is alive.
She didn't walk into a bloody apartment. What do you mean? There was a couple of drops of blood on the sink, one side in the sink, one on the faucet.
Right.
And then there was a stain
on the
floor mat of the bathroom. That's it. It wasn't a very bloody apartment. Mm-hmm. The pictures that you're referencing that people all talked about a very bloody apartment was actually when they had already sprayed all over the place, and it's purple in color, and it looked like that might have been blood, but it wasn't blood. It was just the color substance.
Right. Totally.
But, there was blood in the hallway that was not visible to the human eye, but she tracked it around on her feet, yes.
Anyway, so that just made me think of that. I'm just trying to put myself in this position, like, okay, if I come in the door, I see my mother is dead and crumpled. I run upstairs. I see that my father has been totally mutilated. What would I do?
Hear your sister, who to be mentally defective, she has serious issues. She can't really care for herself. Her mother had to care for her. Right. You hear her in distress and you run away. You don't try to save her. That in and of itself
barring everything else, tells me that he did not just come upon that scene.
Yeah.
That this is not a natural reaction for any human being who has any emotional attachment to any member of his family.
To answer me this,
okay.
If I'm the murderer, why aren't I pretending at least to be with my sister and like go call the ambulance? Like, you know, why? The thing is, why don't
because that
they
doesn't
put on
fit with their plan? But look, they know she can't talk. She can't tell them, the cops. She's not a threat, so they didn't have to kill her too bad. They beat her up, and she would eventually die from those injuries. But it wasn't necessary to kill her because she could not communicate. Would anybody from the outside know that? Or would they leave her dead too?
Right.
Why would they make sure that the mother and the father are obliterated and leave a live witness? How could they be sure? Couldn't just rat them out. He knew she couldn't rat them out.
Okay. But
let's talk about some of this stuff.
Yeah.
They don't, in the call, Sebastian just doesn't say, there's been a murder. He says there's been some kind of break-in. He's minimizing what happened. Mm-hmm. The boxes, the moving boxes, the documents and stuff that were in the room he was staying in were just knocked over. There was nobody rifling through stuff.
Yeah.
It's a staged aspect. I mean, this happens all the time in staged crimes when people are not very good at it. The shower was used all the way down in the basement. Was there another shower that he and Atif used when they were actually staying at the house? That's a pivotal question
right.
that I haven't seen the answer to mm-hmm. in this series. So that's one question that I think we should look at a little closely because that could be instructive. And the alibis that were so carefully set up. The fact is that movies are often used as an alibi because it gives them at least 2 hours in which they could leave and come back and still be covered by that same alibi. So that's
a common ruse.
It's a common ruse, yes. Mm-hmm. The next thing that's really important, though, is that they leave the country.
Okay, I want to, before we get to all that,
okay.
let's go back.
Okay, let's go back.
I got to take us back, okay? Because this series, and I had so many more questions than it really addressed that I had to do lots and lots of research to even just get.
Okay,
like, I didn't even know what the order was that these people were killed. So let's just set the scene.
Mom, dad, and sister, right?
So Sultana was hit at least twice with some blunt force trauma. You know, she was not sexually assaulted. She was in her full regular day clothes, found face down, completely bloodied in the living room.
Then a scarf was put over her head.
It was put over her head?
Well,
or was it just part of her?
We don't know.
Okay.
I mean,
then,
but a scarf was over her head.
Sure. And then upstairs, lying on his back in his bed with his ankles crossed. So somebody who was completely asleep was her husband, Tariq, Atif's father, laying his head completely bludgeoned. He probably never even woke up. You know,
he was
asleep.
Obliterated.
And then somebody had yanked the pillow from under his head and continued hitting him. Now, when the first and then later, the sister was in her bedroom.
Somebody had yanked mm-hmm. the pillow away from his head. Yes,
mm-hmm.
and that very well may have been to shield them from further blood spatter mm-hmm. while the rest of the battering
right.
went on.
Right, and then in her bedroom, which was just on the other side of the wall, Basma had also been beaten, bludgeoned with something. There were gouges in the walls, holes in the drywall. Her sheets had been ripped off the bed. It looked like there was quite a struggle that had
yes.
happened, and she was also face down, horribly injured.
Kind of. She was alive, so, you know.
Okay, I'm just looking at the crime scene, because I've looked
Yeah, but
at
she was alive,
yeah,
so
she
can move.
Yes. Right, right.
She could have turned herself face down. She could have mm-hmm. crawled away. It's not instructive to say she was face down. That's all I'm
okay.
saying.
Okay. So that's what was at the crime scene. In fact, the officer who first responded, Jim Kowalczyk, said that at first he thought it was a murder-suicide because he
mm-hmm.
thought that maybe the women had been shot and then the husband had killed himself in bed because
right.
it was such a huge blood spot. Batter, but of course we come to learn that's not the case.
Yeah, and it's not just blood spatter, it's brain spatter, and so that is something that is consistent with the shotgun to the underside of the head or the front of the face. So it's not unusual that was the interpretation. But then when they went back and looked at the detail, there was no shotgun. And in fact, there was indications that a metal bat had been used.
So my question to you is, because you've talked so much about the different ways of killing people tell you about the killer, what does it tell you that somebody used a bat to smash somebody's head? They weren't stabbed. Their throats weren't slit. I'm sorry if I'm being graphic. They weren't shot. They weren't strangled. It was a bat to the head.
Well, a couple of things tell me young people. Baseball bat, something that, you know, kids and young people use. A VCR and a Walkman, kid stuff.
But those were missing. Those were reported missing.
Well, yeah, I know.
Yeah, no, I'm just.
But
saying.
That's this crime. You know, those three things indicate to me young people. The fact is that the whole incident seems like a well-planned, not criminally sophisticated crime. And it's not something that a hit person would do because of the blood that would be spattered all over this offender. The fact that they were each killed individually, again, tells me it's not somebody who was sophisticated like a hit person. In other words, if you're going to kill three people, the first thing you do is you go after the one that's the biggest threat. Mm. What you do is you take a vulnerable one and put a knife to their throat and bring them to the other one, then tie up the most threatening one, and then get them all in the same room and then kill them. Why do it separately? Why do it separately? Because you know what the situation is. You know you never have to worry. If you know, you never have to worry about the sister because she's autistic and she can't communicate. And you know that the father goes to bed at a certain time or is asleep at this point, and mom is praying. It's a good time to come in and do what you got to do. So it's not a very well-planned crime because, you know, obviously they were caught and convicted.
But after you hit the mom, how do you know she's not going to scream, you know, and then the father's going to come down? I mean, it seems like it could be a very chaotic. It just
right,
sort of,
unfortunately,
it seemed like a very easy thing to do.
Right, that's why I'm saying. It's not the kind of thing that an experienced hitman would do because of that uncertainty. There's some forensic sophistication. It tells me that people who did this were smart, but it tells me also that they weren't experienced as criminals. For example, later on, we'll find out that they had no idea about a paraffin test. And that's something that cops will do in a shooting situation. They'll test the suspects whether or not they fired a firearm. A paraffin test will determine whether or not a firearm was shot by the person or in the close vicinity of that person.
I was not allowed to give critical testimony that I needed to give to explain this evidence. We were defending ourselves in this trial with both arms tied behind our backs.
Okay, so let's pretend that there is no 911 call. Let's pretend that we're just looking at the victimology of this
mm-hmm.
family.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we know they're a low risk. They're low-risk victims, right? Because they live in a very quiet Somerset neighborhood in Bellevue, state of Washington.
Yeah, no crimes, relatively no murders. They're a peaceful family. You know, they're educated and well-off and doing fine.
Yeah, so, father's a successful engineer. Even the mother is a doctor in nutrition. The sister apparently contracted spinal meningitis when she was young, and now people call her autistic. Sometimes I don't think that that's correct. I think she, you know, had a brain injury after her illness. Thank you. So just a very quiet family.
Right. I mean, the only issue is, and this will come to bear later, is that the father has made what could be deemed some kind of controversial statement about True East. The ex-girlfriend of Sebastian is talking about other very solid evidence that came in suggesting that mm-hmm. fundamentalist killed the family. She said there's three categories of tips. All of them are informant-based. And, of course, you always have to sort of take that with a grain of salt because it's informant-based. There usually is a reason why an informant wants to give information to benefit himself. But anyway, that said...
But it seems like that should have been...
pursued, mm-hmm. it may have been pursued mm-hmm. to a certain degree, but not extremely. And part of it is, as I said before, one, she lists the three different types of tips.
Mm-hmm.
RCMP informant said that there was a hit ordered.
Yeah.
Seattle said that Al Fuqua mm-hmm. was involved, and the FBI said that an imam ordered the murder. All three of those would indicate that the person doing this would have been sophisticated criminally in doing hits.
Mm.
And like I said, the crime scene itself says something totally
right.
different.
And there had been, I think there had been violence against certain Muslims from that group. And
right,
Dr. Ruffay, he had co-founded the Canadian-Pakistan Friendship Organization. And years later, his close friend, Riyasat Ali Khan, who was another moderate Muslim activist, was assassinated outside his Surrey home. So, you know, there was violence certainly going on.
And they also say in the documentary that they said that there was another family that was killed, and that family were close friends with the owner of the engineering company that Dr. Ruffay worked for. To me, that's an extremely huge leap mm-hmm. to say they're close friends with the owner of that company and that's what links them to this crime, because they're in a Muslim community and that's probably where that close friendship, and I'm putting that in air quotes, comes from. And to say that that makes these two murders similar, look at the details of that hit. Look at how that family was killed versus how this family was killed. And if you don't know the details, then please don't put them together. Because if they weren't killed in exactly the same manner or a very consistent manner with all sorts of ridiculousness, like spending time after you murder a family, knowing that there are more members of this family, after you murder them, spending time to take a shower in that home, after you've killed somebody in that home, no.
Yeah,
again,
why not wait till a thief comes home and kill him too?
Exactly.
I mean, if you're gonna annihilate a family.
And why not kill the daughter and make sure she's dead? And how is it that a thief knew that his sister was still alive and walked away?
I can't stand that.
Again, that thing alone condemns him in my book.
Do you think, though, just trying to be neutral for a second, do you think in a post 9/11 world there would have been more?
Yeah, obviously, they would have looked at it more.
Yeah.
But you also have to understand this wasn't post 9/11. There wasn't a level of activity of Al Fuqua in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
That rose over time.
Yeah.
So you can't just say, okay, because later, many years later, this kind of stuff was going on in the United States that it was going on many years earlier. You can't say that. So, yes, it would have gotten more focused because at that time there was more need to be focused. However, it's a small-town police department. They pretty much knew that these guys did it, and so they focused mainly on that. Maybe that's not the best thing in the world to do, but it doesn't negate everything that these defendants did. So I want to focus on that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it, you know. They are a very low-risk family. There's no indications of a break-in. There's no and particularly if there was a break-in, then the locations of the family members would have been different.
Right.
It's pretty clear that mom was praying when she was killed. It's pretty clear that dad was sleeping when he was killed. And it's pretty clear that the sister was awake if somebody was kicking in a door or breaking in somehow, then I think family would have gathered, family would have rallied to each other's defense, and you wouldn't have had the same thing. No, the indicators are here that they all felt safe and were going about their normal activities when this crime started.
And if somebody was going to break in, they would certainly take more. Or if they were out for some special paper that he had, you know, they would have
Yeah, unless they were just trying to hit him. If they were just trying to kill him, then they would not have taken a VCR and a Walkman. And that's the kid stuff here. That's the criminal lack of sophistication here. if they had really wanted to set this up to look like a hit, then they wouldn't have taken anything. What hitman is going to need a VCR or a Walkman? I mean, of course, he's not going to take anything that would tie him to that crime. It's just ridiculous. It is a childish thing. It is a major mistake that they made.
And the son, Atif, apparently had never been in trouble before, you know, was, again, high achiever,
right.
Ivy League school. Is Cornell Ivy League? Anyway.
Yes, it is.
Ivy League school, Cornell, away from home this whole time.
But here's the thing. It's not unusual in team crimes to have one of them being a leader and the other being a follower. And they both have to have sort of a meeting of the minds, but one usually is driving the train. You have a dominant personality and a submissive personality, and that's why they pair up very well.
Okay. So the police investigate, they're looking for forensic clues. And so this is the thing that made me just really go, okay, I really want to look at the science. I don't want to look at, I know that your thing is behavior and looking at.
Yeah, well, it's
that's
important.
Fine. That's it's very important.
It's also what this podcast is too.
Yeah, definitely. But I wanted to just put that aside for a second and just look at the pure science, because I just didn't want to be swayed by, you know, one of these teens is very unlikable, you know, and doesn't do him, even if he was innocent, let's say he was innocent, doesn't do himself any favors.
Okay.
Just like Amanda Knox, Damien Eccles. It's kind of, I was feeling like I wanted to stay true to.
Okay, whatever. What science you want to talk about?
So if you look at the forensics, they didn't find a murder weapon. They figure out that it must have been a baseball bat based on finding aluminum in the wall and other things and a blood mark.
From the tip of the bat, right?
Right. So they
and
take the
Emmy has said that a bat produced the wounds that he saw on all three victims.
Right. Despite all of the blood and brain matter and everything everywhere, when they take Sebastian and Atif's clothing, they don't find any blood
right,
on them.
Which we understand totally. That's a non sequitur because he said we did it without clothing on.
Right. I'm going. Yeah, I know.
I know.
I'm just going through.
Okay.
You know, if I'm trying to. And the boys have been there for a few days, so of course their fingerprints are going to be around. They've used the showers, so.
Well, that's you know. Have they used that shower in the basement? Have they?
That's the question.
Right. I know. Yeah. That's the only question that has been developed so far that would call into question some evidence or absolutely convict them. So that's one thing we have to try to find out if there's any testimony about that.
Right. Well, they do find Sebastian's hair in that shower, and they also find
in the shower in the basement mm-hmm. with blood from the father.
Right, right.
Now, they also bring up in the defense in the trial that there's a spot of blood of the father and there is other DNA as well. The question is whether that other DNA was blood or not. They say the same thing about the blood stain in the garage. There is a blood stain from the father and there's other DNA. They don't say whether the other DNA is from blood or not. And that's a pivotal question because A, if it isn't blood, it could be DNA that is trace, that is just, you know.
Transfer
from somebody else. There's a fingerprint on the shower in the basement, and it's not the defendant. But fingerprints can stay
right.
indefinitely.
That's what I kept thinking, is that this is
a house
dated. They just moved into. It could be the former
of
owners.
Course.
I
and
mean,
both of those, yeah. That's exactly what I was trying to say. Mm-hmm. Both of those things cannot be dated. So it's very easy to construct a scenario just like you just did in which, I mean, people shave in the shower, you know, there's blood in the bathroom all the time. So it's not unusual for that. People fix cars and so forth in the garage. It's also not unusual to bleed. So just because somebody dropped blood today on top of blood that was there 10 months ago, you can't distinguish from that. So that's a difficult situation.
The police are convinced that the killer took a shower after the murders,
yes.
Which is a huge, if that's true, then that's a huge clue, I think,
well,
you know, who would be comfortable enough to do
right.
that.
Right, and when we get forward to, and we're talking about the confessions in this case, you have to understand that did the police at that time release to the public that they believed that the killer took a shower in that shower at that time? Or is that something that was added by the defendants? And those are the things. It's the details of the confession that are going to tell us whether it's truthful or not. And you'll see the series, you know, have people remarking that things within their confessions are inconsistent and so on and so forth. But let's talk about the expertise of that. Let's actually go into the nuances of that when we get to that part of the case.
So there's a lot of footprints because of all of the blood at the crime scene. There were a lot of footprints, not necessarily shoe prints. They couldn't identify shoe prints. And something I thought of, well, maybe the killers use that bathroom to clean their shoes up, not necessarily take a shower. I didn't know if that would
be true. There were no shoes. The blood prints were not in shoes. They were in socks or bare feet. So they wouldn't have used the shower to clean off their shoes because they weren't using their shoes during the crime. The shoes were definitely not on during the crime because when they were walking around in the bloody scenes, they did not have shoe prints. Mm-hmm. So, but again, going back to the confessions, a detail that was said by one of the defendants, by a thief, was that we wore gloves and we threw our socks out the windows of the car. We wore socks. And then we'll get to that later.
Yeah.
But those are things that we're going to have to talk about. You're going to have to address.
Right. So now let's get into the post-offense behavior. So this is the part where I get uncomfortable, and I know that you'll talk me all through this and get me through it, because as you've said, people act different ways, respond differently to tragedy. So I'm sort of taking this isolated, you know what I mean?
But the 911 call is very discordant. It is not, it's not just that I'm saying, oh, this is not like how people act. Within itself, the content of that call itself is completely fighting itself, because it's as if he can't form a sentence or a complete thought. He's mumbling. He's saying, all this kind of stuff. He's doing that heavy breathing thing. But when he wants to get that cop off the phone, he says complete sentences. He says it very articulately. There's absolutely no hesitation. There's no heavy breathing. It just totally changes. And that kind of inconsistency, unless you're a psychopath, how quickly psychopaths recover from bad situations, they recover very quickly. Human beings that don't have psychopathy usually have sustained difficulties when they encounter something as tragic and as horrific as what this scene was. Right. They did not respond in that way, in any way, shape, or form. However, they were put up in a motel by the cops. They were questioned repeatedly. Mm-hmm. They kept saying things that didn't make sense. The two biggest things, again, they did not help the sister. Explain that to me, Lisa. Why would that happen?
What is the argument? I cannot imagine why you would.
They said it
be
was because they were afraid, yet they stood right outside the house. If they were afraid that the bad guy was in there, so afraid that they wouldn't help a dying sister.
I can't understand.
Why would they stand right outside the house? It just does not make sense. Why wouldn't they defend themselves? Why wouldn't they lock themselves in their car? Why wouldn't they drive somewhere else? Why wouldn't they get weapons and go back in to try to get her out to help her?
Make sure, something.
They didn't do any of that. So that's the biggest first thing. The second biggest thing is, not only did they flee the country, and yes, I said flee the country, on the day that the funeral was happening for their murdered family members, they blamed the police for not telling them that that's the day of the funeral. Mm-hmm. When they knew, in fact, the Muslim faith demands it to be done within 3 days. And who's responsible for cleaning the bodies and burying them within 3 days? The family of the victims.
Okay.
So those two things together are outrageously monstrous in terms of evidence against them.
I totally hear that. And again, it's going to sound like
All right. You may want to discount it, but
I'm not discounting it. I'm saying is I just want to go back a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So in the confession tapes, the prosecutor is interviewed quite a bit, and so are one of the detectives, and they say that the boys had no emotional, they weren't emotional, they weren't this and that, but the the responding officers on the scene actually say that they were emotional. They were almost sick. They were, you know, very upset. So I just want to sort of,
okay,
you know.
But go back to what Sebastian said with Mr. Big. And he says, if you're worried about us breaking now, back then it was tough because the cops kept asking us over and over again. Yeah. And when they brought it up, when they would ask us questions about it, it would make us sick inside because they knew they were guilty.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not that they were thinking, oh my God, these poor people got brutalized and the whole time I felt sick about that. No, when they brought it up to us, when they kept coming back to us and asking us questions, it would make us sick inside.
Right. So according to them, they were questioned by the police and the police have actually admitted this, I feel like, in the appeal, the appeal documents that I've read, that so they are from Canada, right? They're not from Bellevue. So that Atif thinks that the funeral is not going to happen in Bellevue. It's going to happen back with his relatives in Canada.
No, but so, what do you mean? Who said that? What do you mean?
I mean, that's what...
But it can't be done.
Why can't it be done?
And plus, he had access to all his family members. Why wasn't he interacting with his other family members?
He claims that he didn't have access.
What do you mean? How could he not have access to them?
I'm just telling you what it says.
His claim is bogus.
He claims that he did give the police, that the consulate called the Bellevue Police Department, that they got permission for them to go back to travel back to Canada. What was the other thing I was going to say?
Well, if they did, they certainly didn't get it from the prosecutor and the lead detective because they didn't know. Secondly, what was the reason for them having to go back to Canada? What was that purpose? What was the purpose of that?
Because that's where they're from. That's where all the rest of the family is. I'm sorry.
No, it isn't. The family was there.
They didn't know that the family. I'm not defending them. I'm just telling you.
I know, but what I'm saying is that's bullshit. That's a complete lie. They didn't know that the family was there.
They didn't know that the Bellevue family had arrived yet. They didn't know when the bodies were going to be released because they're murder victims.
Yeah, but
I'm not defending them. But Atif
knew. All right. But Atif knew that his faith demanded that the family get the body, clean it, and bury it within 3 days of death. He knew that. And yet, he didn't talk to any of his family members about it. And yet, he left on the third day. It just rings false, like okay. So much else of his behavior.
Okay. Yeah. So the boys do go back to Canada. They stay with Sebastian's family. And when he sees on the news that there has been a funeral in Bellevue, he's very upset, and then later on, they do have a memorial service in
which he doesn't go to.
Well, he does go to it.
No, he walks up to it. He doesn't go to the service
because he's pursued by the paparazzi.
He weren't going into the mosque. No, you're telling me what you're telling me is his story about it, but you can actually see what happened.
I watched it too.
So
I actually didn't know what that was when I first watched in the confession tapes. I didn't know where that was occurring and what. And it was only later watching Dateline and some of the others that I realized.
Yeah, that was the mosque. And they went to the door because he was confronted and asked why he wasn't cooperating with the police. He turned around and ran, and both of them ran in. They were laughing and joking. They piled in the back of the car and they drove off. That's what they did.
Yeah.
Their behavior speaks volumes.
All right. So the police's theory is that this murder was for insurance money. And indeed, Atif did receive something like, what, $300,000?
At least, of
insurance money.
Insurance money and selling the house and assets. Mm-hmm. He made at least $300,000. It may be much more. I think he made $300,000 from one insurance policy. And I think they sold the house as well. There's another insurance policy, but I think only the U.S. one paid immediately.
So the boys start living together. They rent an apartment. They get a fancy car. And the police in Canada bug their house and have about like 4,000 hours of tapes trying to find something incriminating that they say. And through all those 4,000 hours, apparently, they don't give any hint at all as to what's, you know, gone on, which I thought was weird that if you were alone with your, what do you call him?
A co-conspirator,
that something would be given up, some clue would be given.
Well, maybe they didn't do that at home. I don't know. Maybe they did that elsewhere. But You can't explain it. It just didn't happen.
Yeah, it's just something that I thought was odd. You know, we didn't really talk much about the alibis, but we could talk a little bit more before we move on.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the fact is that they had pretty solid alibis, except that a movie is only an alibi for the minutes in which they were actually seen. Mm-hmm. It's very easy to sneak out the back of a movie theater. They all have exit doors. There's people go in and out of the show all the time to go to the bathroom and so on and so forth. They may never have actually gone in to see the movie at all. They could have walked in, made their little show on the way in, and then gone into the bathroom. And then when everybody went into the movie, they could have just walked out with the next crowd that was leaving.
Yeah.
Nobody would have been the wiser. It gives them at least a two-hour window. So how far are they from the house? How long did it take to do that and clean up? I mean, it's all doable in that time period. And again, I have to keep going back to this. The details of that they gave Mr. Big, you have to scrutinize that to make sure that Mr. Big didn't give them information and that information wasn't out in the public, but that the cops were holding it back, like the aluminum bat and what was going on in the shower and so on and so forth.
My question would have been to those people who spoke to their alibis, what were they wearing? And were those the same clothes that the police found them in later?
Right.
To me, that would have been the...
I know one guy said army shirt or army jacket that one of them was wearing. But I don't know.
With all that blood spatter, and especially what they said about somebody was in the way of the blood spatter. So definitely got stuff on their clothes.
No. The confession was that they didn't wear clothes.
Well, he said that Sebastian said that he was naked, but... But the police say that there was at least two other people in
right,
the room.
No, he said that we were.
He said, if you do it naked.
No, he said.
All of them were naked?
There's only two of them. What do you mean?
Well,
both of them.
Well, the police thought that Jimmy actually was there, too.
No, I don't think so.
Three of them were there, too. But anyway, in
what?
Any case.
I mean, where did he go then? I thought he was in Canada at the time. He wouldn't know that. That's ridiculous. I never heard that, but maybe it's true.
Okay.
No, I mean, but why wouldn't he be in the alibi then? The point is that they were naked when they did this, but we'll get into the confessions when we get to that part. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So the police are sure that they've got their man, and they cannot get to them. The American police cannot get to them because they're in Canada.
Right. Again, guilty behavior. It is absolutely something that you're allowed to mention in a U.S. court of law, that somebody flees the jurisdiction to a jurisdiction that will highly likely not extradite them because it's a death penalty case.
Right. So they enlist the Mounties, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. Is that what it is?
Yeah, RCMP.
And so they engage them to try to do a sting. Now, I'd never heard of...
Well, actually, the RCMP started their own investigation and did the sting as part of the normal course of business there. I mean, it certainly has been done in the United States many times. Mm-hmm. It's kind of been frowned upon since Abscam, where it was done in a big way by the FBI. That case kind of fell apart. And I think as a result of that, they stopped doing Mr. Big cases here in the United States.
You want to explain to the people what Mr. Big, what that all means?
It's just...
I never heard of it before.
Okay. It's just a generic term for an undercover operation in which undercover agents, ingratiate themselves into the circle of friends and colleagues of the suspects. And then, you know, they say that they work for somebody who's much more involved, much more wealthy, much more sophisticated, much more involved in crime, much more badass. And eventually they get to meet this person. And what this does is it sort of gives a very layered, realistic effect for this criminal enterprise. People who idolize them, like these guys did, are taken in by it pretty easily. So it was a sophisticated and effective technique to get them to talk.
I consider having my family the greatest of privileges, sir. They're with me in my memory today. I'm going to continue to struggle for the truth in this case of our innocence, because I won't betray their hopes for me or their expectations of me, which I'm proud to say that they have.
Okay, so let's talk about the Mr. Big tapes that they got. So, Jim, try for me, just pretend like you don't know anything about these guys. Nothing. Right. You don't know anything about anything. I just want you to tell me what you've seen in that behavior, because there's so much happening in this hotel room where they have these tapes. Now, mm-hmm. I'm sure that there's a lot more tape that there is, and I kind of wish that you could get your hands on that and watch the whole thing to see context and if they brag about other things. But in this tape, I'm going to use a little C, coerced, not big C, coerced, but they're kind of coerced into telling the story, narrating the story of
I don't think you should use the word coerced. They were tricked. Mm-hmm. Coercion is a totally different thing.
Okay.
And I was looking, believe me, for indications. They are young. There's mm-hmm. no question about it. Mm-hmm. They're not 15.
Mm-hmm.
They're a little more sophisticated than, let's say, Brendan Dassey, for example. Okay. They're intelligent. We're talking about somebody who's going to an Ivy League school, very difficult to get into. By all accounts, Sebastian is also very intelligent. Certainly, you're not dealing with somebody who's got a 70 IQ. That's the base rate there. The next thing I was looking for was, are these suspects intimidated? If you're intimidated by the people or the process, yes, that can lead to coercion. Are there threats being made? That's another level. So in this particular scenario, they did a couple of things. They bought up the issue with the murders. They said, it's my understanding that the cops are coming for you. They showed a report. Now, this is something that in the United States, we cannot do. We cannot make up a fake report that tells lies about the forensics. Now, what the district attorney said was that report had truths, not lies in it. The truth was that they were being looked at. The truth was that they did find hair evidence that linked them. And the truth was that they did find DNA evidence that kind of linked them. And the kind of was that it's blood from upstairs. The father's DNA on his blood was in the shower where Sebastian's hair was. So that DNA evidence, kind of linked. I mean, it's circumstantial, but it did link them. The lie was that there were charges planned. So personally, I would have liked it if that didn't happen. Personally, I would have thought that if they had done it without making that statement, without turning the pressure up on them, it would have been better. But again, I look at this scenario as a whole, and I look at their behavior as a whole, and I look at what they did and how Sebastian related these things, how he bragged about it, how he said, oh, I didn't tell you that because I just figured you realized that, or you knew that, or you would assume that, or whatever. And he kept saying, no, I don't want to assume anything. Tell me all the details. Tell me what they are. But here's the thing. You heard this when we talked about other cases. When somebody's being interrogated and they act out a particular act while they're telling a story, it is an indicator of veracity. It is something that indicates what they're saying at that time is actually true. And what he said is, I took a shower to clean it off. And then he acts it out, the blood and that kind of stuff. To me, That is a behavioral indicator that he experienced that memory, that he isn't just making it up. The same thing with Joran van der Sloot. When he talked about Natalie Holloway having a seizure, he acted it out. And I believe that did actually happen. And the same thing in the JonBenet Ramsey case as well. When people act out things, it's an indicator of veracity. So that's something that was important to me during these confessions. The other thing was that, I just remembered a detail. I had a gonch on. Now, a gonch.
What is that?
I'm thinking it had to do with, it's like a, can you look it up? It's like a,
in two ways to spell Canadian slang words meaning underwear. Ginch, gaunch, gitch.
Okay. Well, that's interesting because they found in the washing machine two pair of underwear.
I know, but every time anybody comes home for anytime, don't get me wrong. I think that I
anytime
when you come home from college, the first thing you do is you do your laundry. So yeah,
but wait, your laundry. One piece of your underwear and one piece of his underwear.
Are we sure that was all that was in there?
Yes.
Okay.
Just two pair of underwear. No socks, no t-shirts, nothing.
Mm.
Why? Because they stripped down to that, and that's all they had to wash.
Yeah.
Oh, the other thing was, Mr. Biggs said this. He goes, when you washed yourself on the night of the murder, did you wash yourself with red towels? Because they were talking about in that report that there were red fibers mixed with his hair. And he said, and Sebastian said, I don't even know. And he said, what do you mean you don't know? He said, I don't even remember what fucking color the towels were there. He didn't say, wait a minute, I didn't wash myself in the shower that night.
Yeah.
And that's one of those very sophisticated questions that I'm so glad he asked, because if you didn't do it, wait a minute, I didn't wash myself on that night. I was not there for that murder. He didn't do that at all. And he fell right into it and he gave away information. He said, I don't remember what fucking color the towels were there. So that was a very telling thing. And he said, I don't know shit about bloodstains in the garage. Well, you know what? It's possible that the cops tracked the blood into the garage.
Oh.
That when Sebastian and Atif came out from the house,
yeah,
that they, you know, they did their little running around thing. Like, now we have to go back in dressed,
right,
and be like the discoverers.
Sure.
That they're running around then, unwittingly tracked some into the garage. So I think those are two other possibilities, as well as the fact that there is other DNA mixed in with that blood stain. I think could be an artifact from the family that lived there before.
What do you think when you first saw Sebastian sitting on that couch and just the way that he was, there's something about it. At first I was like, well, maybe this is like a young kid who's just bullshitting. And
right, right. Way.
But then, you know.
Well, yeah. I think Michael Levine's part in this story. And, you know, Michael Levine is a very respected long-term undercover operative. And he did the same kind of stuff.
Yeah.
He did exactly this same kind of stuff. He did.
Yeah, I found him very believable from
yes.
his point of view, from
right.
his lens. I found
right.
him believable.
Yes, but you know what he was trying to say is this is all braggadocio,
mm-hmm.
and yes, that can happen absolutely. But again, braggadocio, it does not impugn upon the person bragging the knowledge of details that they shouldn't otherwise know. How did Sebastian know that it was a metal bat? Did they, in a press release the fact that they found aluminum shards in the shape of a, you know, where the bat hit, and that's how they determined it was an aluminum bat? I don't know. And so that would be an important detail to know, to find out.
Remember when they finally get Atif to go into this? You know what? These guys are not intelligent. I'm sorry. I bristle. The two convicted. You know.
What do you mean not intelligent?
They're not intelligent.
So,
I think that he couldn't take it. He couldn't take the pressure. He couldn't take being away from his mommy who did his laundry all the time. And so in this short-sighted way, $300,000 of an insurance policy is nothing. I mean, to a really successful person, that's nothing. But that was a short term.
But to an 18-year-old
kid, yes.
That's
what I'm saying, though.
To
me, that's
impulsive.
Not intelligent. And after.
Well, that's. No, that's a difference between. That's. Intelligence is not. It doesn't have to mean that you're practically savvy. That, you know, it was a stupid, bonehead, impulsive thing to do. They got caught. They're in jail for the rest of their lives and a couple more. But because of it. But. That doesn't mean they're not intelligent people. They're just not criminally sophisticated. That's the difference.
I mean, intelligent. I mean, this Sebastian just, if he's innocent, then he did himself no favors by getting involved, by being conned, and going into this what is this I just found...
Wait, by being conned? By who? He's the one?
By the agents. By the agents. Like, oh, I've lost my keys and come for a drink. I mean, he's so...
He's so self-centered.
Yes, but influenced by this, like, nothing. This,
yeah, but he was looking up to them.
I just don't think an intelligent person would think that that was the kind of life, that was the key to getting a screenplay done. And
That's another thing. Let's talk about a screenplay. Mm-hmm. So, your parents and your sister get brutally murdered. So, you write a screenplay about what? About what?
About their murder and how you're innocent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's how you're going to prove it. You're going to run to another country...
I know.
And prove it by writing a screenplay about it.
Yeah, no. The fact that he didn't...
Or are you boasting about it like OJ did, if I had killed her?
Yeah, no.
If I had done it.
I mean, forget about everything else. The fact, for me, you know, the fact that he didn't pursue finding their killer, your entire family is annihilated, that he didn't go back to college to, you know, his parents, you know... gave him the means to go to college. The fact he didn't finish that, the fact he didn't make any attempt to make a life for himself, that he kept living with his buddy, that, for me, is what convinced me that they were guilty. Well, I mean, I know that
they were in
not,
it together?
Yeah, and that they were guilty. And I know that that's not, like, what do you call it, a professional way to look at it, but that's my gut.
The other thing that Atif, when Mr. Big said, why did you do this? And he said, to set ourselves up so we could become richer. And then he goes on to say, and more successful, blah, 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 blah. I believe that the Mr. Big operations can manipulate vulnerable, young, impressionable people. But the test is, did they give information that was not public? Did they confirm things that the cops did not tell them? And that would be the way to drill down and make sure this was not a false confession. And so that kind of information, you know, the bat being made of aluminum, the shower downstairs, the gaunch or whatever, you know, you want to call it, the underwear.
And the fact that he had to keep hitting the daughter that he talked about.
That she was moving around. Right, right.
I mean, that was the most disgusting thing. Yeah. And that Atif laughed. I mean, how I just can't. I can't.
Now we have to talk about Teresa Olson. So
Let's
talk about the defense attorney.
Okay. So they get arrested. It takes them 6 years to get them even out of Canada. Were they incarcerated in that time? Or are they free?
No, I'm sure they were free.
All right. So they get brought back to Bellevue, and
they have a defense team.
What in the
Well, I mean, this is very common charismatic psychopath behavior where I believe that Sebastian manipulated Teresa Olson into a sexual relationship. I do not believe that she initiated it, although he was tall and handsome and articulate and charismatic. I believe that he did, and it probably backfired to a great degree on him.
What's the end game with that? I mean, she has to defend
her.
Well, for him, it's like she has to defend him anyway. It's not like what? I don't.
What do you mean? She couldn't defend him. She got kicked off the case.
I mean, that's what I mean. Like, why court her that way? Why have a sexual relationship with her?
Because he could.
Because he could. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
You know. Yeah. I mean, come on. I mean,
that's what I'm saying. If he's so smart, why does he do that?
Intelligence and practical applications of that intelligence are two different things. He is intelligent. You could tell by his articulation. You could tell by his father's articulation. The fact is that he's an intelligent guy who, like his girlfriend described, smart but lazy student. Mm. So there was much made of the sort of inconsistencies in the different accounts that Sebastian and Atif gave. So Sebastian said that Atif was downstairs or around the corner or whatever. He wasn't actually there when the father was beaten to death. There seemed to be a blood spatter shadow. And that means that, like, when somebody's beating somebody with a baseball bat in the head and it becomes pulpy, bloody mess, that every time they hit the bat down onto the head. And every time they lift it up back to swing it again, they're going to be spraying blood, spattering it all over. If there's an interruption, if there's a wall and the spatter hits that wall, if there's an interruption roughly in the shape of a human torso, that's because somebody was standing there and they're getting the blood on them, so it's not making its way all the way to the wall. And in this case, if they were naked, then that could be washed off. And they probably, what I believe is the reason why Sebastian went downstairs to that basement shower was because a thief used the shower upstairs that they normally used, and that meant that Sebastian either had to get naked in a shower with a thief, because they had to do this quickly, because they had a very tight window of time, and he didn't want to do that, so he went downstairs and took a shower separately. I believe that's what happened. But then the other thing was, they said that he didn't watch his father getting pummeled. But that doesn't mean, just because there's a blood spatter shadow, doesn't mean that he was facing the beating.
Sure.
So he could have been standing there, but facing away. And he may have pulled the pillow out from under his father for two reasons. One is the pillow would have softened the blow from the bat, you know, even though it's hitting the head, but it's the head is then bouncing down on a pillow. So maybe he took it away to make more effective, you know, blows. Or he used the pillow to cover himself because blood was spattering all over the place. And we know that when it was pulled across away from the father, that created a swipe on one side of the pillow of blood, but on the other side of the pillow, it then had a bunch of spatter.
Yeah.
So that came afterwards, and that might have been because a thief was using it to protect himself from the spatter from his father.
Why not just smother his father? I'm still, like, taken aback.
It's violence.
Violence. No,
they wanted
it's
to use
like,
violence.
It's just, like, such overkill. I mean, I think
absolutely.
He was hit, like, about 50 times, I think
I don't think it was 50. I think it was at least 15 up to 30. But, I mean, according to the medical examiner.
Yeah.
But the two things that they said about the sister, Sebastian said she was asleep versus she was walking around. Well, that's time dependent. I mean, she could have been asleep when it started, but then she was definitely moving around when she was being beaten. So there's that. And the other inconsistency was about the bat. Sebastian said, I think we got the bat just kicking around. And like as if they found it somewhere. And then Atif said, we bought the bat. We were both in the store. We were both in the store together. So it could be that one or the other forgot about what they did, but it's also could be that they didn't want to, you know, tell the truth about that particular detail. But knowing that it was an aluminum bat, I think is a very telling detail. Then there was what they did with their clothes. And Sebastian said the clothes were each just deposited in different dumpsters around town. And then Atif said the socks and gloves were thrown out the window. He didn't say anything about the clothes. So that's not an inconsistency. That's greater detail. And again, we wore socks. That's consistent with the crime scene forensics. Were they told that there were no sneakers worn? There were no shoes worn? Or is this a detail that corroborated what the cops had not released? So again, those are really important details, and that will make the difference between being able to argue successfully that this was a false confession or it was a true confession. So when the former girlfriend of Sebastian says the confessions were demonstrated to be false, that's not really true. And in the defense summation, the blood spot in the shower that had to reek Rafe's blood and other DNA. But again, was the other DNA blood? And if it was it because that shower was not used frequently by the new people who own the house, but that somebody had bled in it before so recently, them having moved in, and the blood in the garage, the same thing. It's not unusual to have blood tracked by people who are police officers, who aren't really forensically sophisticated, and by defendants, and in this case, these two boys who had to, as part of their ruse, run around the house and make it look like they just discovered this. So they could have, each of them could have tracked blood onto an already existing stain that was in the garage from the previous owners of the house.
Well, one thing I want to mention is in the jury, I think it was in the confession tapes, or it might have been in something else I watched. They talked to some of the jury members, and you know, the jury one of the women was like, oh, you know, Sebastian is so arrogant, this and that and this and that. And the prosecutor is so handsome. So those and things like that, well. I just pushed that away for me because, you know, we've seen in the case of West Memphis 3, Damien Echols, you know, defendants who have a swagger to them or who come across, you know, badly, you know, that can really sway the jury. And I find that very distasteful. Like, look at the facts. Look,
right.
You know what
That's
I mean?
What the
and
jury should be doing. Right.
And she's not a behavioral specialist.
No, not at all.
So those kind of things, I just, but who it cares just, if he's a jerk?
Right, but it just tells you how ridiculous our jury system is. That we have people who could possibly focus and make a decision based on how well the prosecutor looks and how well he dressed.
Yeah.
In comparison to the defense attorney or the defendant.
Yeah.
So that's outrageous. It's ridiculous. Yeah. There should be some like way to prevent that from happening in our system. But the other side of that is this is a doc series. And I can guarantee that the interviews they did with those jurors went on far longer than what we saw on the
yeah,
air.
Sure.
And so they picked those particular details. Because what it did was it made each of those jurors seem like they focused on one point and one point alone, and that's why they convicted. And I don't know if that's an accurate depiction of what they actually did, or that those two are representative of all 12 members of that jury. But it did its job for this particular docuseries,
sure.
And I totally get it, but don't walk away from that and say, oh, that must be what all the jurors said and did, because you just don't know.
Yeah. They do interview in another, I don't know if it's a Dateline or something else I saw. They have like four, maybe six of the jurors there and seem like very nice people, very intelligent people, but they definitely were creeped out by Sebastian eyeballing them during the trial and this and that and this and that. Anyway.
So can we talk now about the final statements after conviction to the judge and the difference between them and how the judge responded to them? Yeah, Sebastian's behavior, both post-murders, pre-arrest, and post-arrest, and during the trial, all that stuff, during the whole Mr. Big thing, that was a major component of this trial, absolutely, as it should be. Because behavior speaks volumes. And many times behavior will tell you what somebody actually is thinking or wanting to do, whereas the words that come out of their mouth are lies.
Right. The only caveat I would say is as we've learned, I hate to bring this up again, but as we learned, you know, Amanda Knox buying underwear and doing cartwheels, you know, like I'm very sensitive to people perceiving people who are odd and people who are not like you as guilt. Now I
it's not quirky behavior that we're talking about in this case.
Yeah, I know.
Not at all. It's not quirky behavior. Yeah. It's very self-centered behavior. It's very arrogant behavior, and it would be what the judge specifically talks about after the sentencing statement. So, the judge gave Sebastian an opportunity to make a statement. And the most critical thing to me out of all of this is that the judge is asking for a statement. The judge is about to sentence him on three convictions for first-degree murder. But who does Sebastian make his statement to? He turns around to the press, to the people in the audience, and he makes a statement to them. And all he ends up doing is pissing off the judge. And that was a boneheaded, stupid move. But just like all the other boneheaded, stupid moves that you talked about with Sebastian, it's driven by his narcissism. It's driven by his arrogance. And the judge called him out on that when he sentenced him to three life terms with no possibility of parole. However, if you contrast that with Atif, now Atif seemed scared and vulnerable, and he made a statement. He's very polite to the judge. He addressed it to the judge. And he basically said how horrible it was that his family was murdered and all this stuff happened, and yada, 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 and how devastated he was by the murders. If I were the judge, I would have said one thing. I would have said, if that were true, then why didn't you help your sister who had been attacked? Because you didn't. I disbelieve you. And therefore, I'm sentencing you to life without parole. So even though the judge was pissed off at Sebastian a lot more than he was pissed off at Atif, they got exactly the same sentences. So tells me that the judge, the judge's emotion didn't drive that decision.
Definitely. Yeah, I was surprised about that. Yeah,
because you would have expected him to have gone lighter on Atif had he actually believed that Atif was remorseful. Because he said, oh, obviously you're remorseful, whereas Sebastian is not. But he punished them exactly the same.
Right. Well, especially because the prosecutor, you know, did make the case that Atif actually did not strike his family member.
Right.
So I thought, well, maybe there'll be some sort of difference in their sentence.
I thought so, too.
I have a question for you, though.
Mm-hmm.
This case went on for a long – I mean, this whole ordeal went on for a very, very long time, like 10 years from the crime to the conviction. If – and I'm – I agree that I think they're guilty. Sorry, guys. However – one thing that makes me wonder is if they're guilty, why didn't one of them turn on each other? You know, why didn't they?
I don't believe they were offered that. I believe the prosecution offered Jimmy that.
Yeah.
And he
that
went
they
for
would
it.
Have especially gone after Atif to try.
No, but
to...
once they get, this is how prosecutions work. If you have two or more, once you get one person to flip, the door closes on all the other ones. The first one in gets the deal. And that's why it's really important. And that's why cops can actually say to defendants, potential defendants, look, there's only one opportunity here. You can come clean right now, or I'm going to go to the next guy. And if he comes clean, you're sunk. Unfortunately, sometimes what that does is when the cops pick the wrong bad actor, in other words, when the cops don't pick the worst guy can actually blame the other guy. So it's a flawed system, but that's absolute. Once they get one guy to say, I'm going to turn on the other guys, they don't need anybody else, so they absolutely won't make a deal with anybody else. There's no option for a deal.
Okay. My other question is, if I were a murderer, wouldn't I be at the funeral and be crying and be just, I mean, you know, that's the other thing.
Unless you were afraid of being arrested and knew this was one opportunity to get out of the country and maybe the only opportunity you have to stay out of jail for the rest of your life or be killed. So,
okay.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, okay.
I mean,
this is something that I think of.
Yeah, I know. It's I get it. And it makes sense. But these guys were not criminally sophisticated. They were smart enough to plan and execute this crime very effectively. They were not smart enough to get away with it. And they certainly weren't smart enough to shut their mouths like Jimmy was for a good part of the time during his interaction with Mr. Big. But eventually, he did say, okay, I'll tell you. And those guys told me, and he's the one that did it.
Yeah. I think it's not to say that Jim and I don't think that there are false confessions out there.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And
Brendan Dassey, perfect example.
Yeah.
Here's a guy who basically you could see in the actual tapes. You can hear him guessing and then them guiding him.
Yeah.
And actually then saying, all right, I'm so frustrated with you not giving me the right answer that I want that I'm going to just go ahead and say to you, who shot her in the head? I mean, that kind of information, if that happened here, then you can't rely on the confession, even if it isn't coerced. You can't rely on
it. Right, right, right.
If that didn't happen here, then the information that came out was damning to them and their case. And that's why they got convicted.
Absolutely. The other confessions we've studied have been like hours and hours of pressure and duress and stress. And it's just, to my untrained eye, that is not really what happened in this case. So there you go. So that is our review of the first two episodes of The Confession Tapes. I haven't watched any of the other ones.
No, not yet. it was a luxury for me to be able to watch two of them right now. So
hopefully when Laura comes back, we can
we can do more. Because I mean, I saw the beginning of the next episode, and that looks interesting. And I do believe, and I absolutely have gone through a number of cases in my career where I have uncovered false confessions by people. And there was actually one in a case that I worked that, you know, unfortunately, the cops told us something that wasn't true. Mm. And they completely misrepresented what happened in that interrogation room. And like in many false confession cases, they did not record the first 4 hours of the interrogation. And they claimed that the first recording was from the beginning. And later it came out that, no, there was 4 hours preceding it, during which time they gave out all the information that came back in the tape-recorded conversation. So, unfortunately, you know, that case was doomed because of it, and those cops ended up paying for it.
All right. Well, we look forward to more of these confession tapes on Netflix.
Yes. And if you have other series that you think we should watch and comment on, we'd be happy to, given time. I mean, we have a lot of stuff.
Yeah,
and
a lot going on.
We're doing a number of other cases, and we got some great things in store for you, really great surprises. So can't wait. Thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile.
If you like our podcast, there are a few things that you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcast and leave us a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotion and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go over to Facebook and like our Facebook page. And one last thing is please tell all your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening to us. We really appreciate you.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter or counselling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214-946-4357, or go on their website www.genesisshelter.org or the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.